Thank you, Eli, especially for the whole, you know, dancing yoga reveal. So, I'm going to talk about four spirits today. But first, I'm going to take 10 minutes to sort of frame Cambodia, my thesis, what on earth I'm talking about. Okay? So, my research, I was looking into how people recover from war. I was specifically interested in how and why people resettled this war-altered landscape in northwest Cambodia. And to start, I'm going to just describe, I'm going to read briefly to you. It'll take 3 minutes. I timed it. I'm on a stopwatch. Hold on, let me start the stopwatch. Okay, that would be good. I want to describe the landscape by reading about it, because it's not a landscape that will be familiar to most of us, because most of us haven't lived or worked in northwest Cambodia. But what I'm going to be talking about today is a little village that translates into English well, if you call it the village of Handsome, Khmer Reksma Sangha. And this is a village that was abandoned during the long decades in Cambodia of war. And it wasn't resettled until about 1996, when the Khmer Rouge forces in that area surrendered and peace returned to that part of Cambodia. So I'm going to start by reading you a description of this landscape for my thesis. And then I promise I won't do any more extensive reading until the end. Then there's one more story. All right. So, Handsome Village has been both a village and a forest. Imagine this forest, if you will, as it looked 15 years ago, when people first began to resettle the area at the end of the war. Secondary forest covers a landscape that was once cultivated, but has since stood fallow for almost 20 years. It is a forest in which a war was fought, a landscape choked with undergrowth and full of the material remnants of earlier eras. It is only as people begin to claim plots of land in this forested landscape and clear these plots by hand that the artifacts of the past begin to be encountered. Settlers to this area enter a landscape of both wilderness and ruination. The landscape is filled with the remnants of war, unexploded ordnance, unused ordnance, ammunition dumps, and caches of guns, fragments of exploded ordnance, bullet cartridges, and iron spike jacks litter the forest floor. Trenches dug for soldiers manning defensive perimeters often contain this kind of war junk, and the forest is full of these kinds of trenches. Anti-personnel mines and anti-tank mines have been placed both above and beneath the ground. In addition to war debris, other traces of the soldiers remain. Medicine bottles are sometimes found, along with hammocks, cooking implements, shoes, and sarongs. The remains of the dead are also present. Their bones lie on the forest floor or are buried in shallow graves. Traces of the pre-war past are also present. This area was once a prosperous plantation district, famed for the fertility of its soil and its orchards. The houses of the original residents have been destroyed by war and fire. Clay roof tiles, rusted nails, and middens of broken dishes remain. Also, a few of these long-vanished residents' fruit trees still stand in the jungle. Occasionally, treasure is found beneath the ground, largely heirlooms from Buddhist temples that were buried to keep them safe from the ravages of the war. In short, this is a landscape littered with material remains. It is a place in which the ground both hides and reveals things. Traces of the past quite literally do not stay buried in this landscape. Artifacts and ordnance work their way slowly to the surface of the earth like a thorn in a wound. Okay, so who resettled this landscape and why would they come to this place? The answer to who is that it was three groups of people. It was demobilized soldiers at the end of the war. It was internally displaced people. Those are people who had to leave their homes during the war but hadn't crossed the border into Thailand, so they'd moved to other parts of Cambodia. And also returning refugees from the border camps in Thailand. All of these people at the close of the war in Cambodia were landless. They'd been away when the country had redistributed land. So when they came back or they stopped fighting, all the arable land that was free of landmines had already been given out to other people. Why here? Northwest Cambodia, where the fighting went on until the late 1990s, the very end of the war in Cambodia, was pretty much the only place that was free of human occupants at the end of the war, because it had been the former front lines. So basically, the only land that was available to people was these former battlefields. And people realized if they were willing to risk their lives trying to clear and cultivate this land, they could claim it for their own. So that's the backdrop to my entire thesis. We're talking about spirits today, but this is the landscape in which people are living and operating. So the people who came there gambled with their lives, and they were aware of that. This place was full of peril and threat. But also, it held this potential, right? If you could survive it, you could have land at the end of that period. So it both held a promise for people of returning to an agricultural future, and it held the danger of death. And these post-war settlers are the people that I did my research with, and everything I'm telling you today is stories and things that they believe and told me while I was in Cambodia. Now, I spent a year in this village of Handsome in 2009. I lived in the home of the village chief, which was required of me. There were 9 of us living there. It was a 3-room house on wooden stilts. And I spent most of my time going around on a rackety old motorbike bothering people, as anthropologists do. So talking to people, interviewing them, trying to help farm. I was terrible at that. They made me stop very quickly. And occasionally going around with D-miners, although not very often, because it's dangerous. But once in a while, I was allowed to go along. Now, when I got there, there had been a decade of clearance of landmines, both formal by organizations, official deminers, and informal by farmers who were demining their land themselves. When I got there, there were homes and farms and patches of forest. It was once again looked recognizably like an agricultural landscape. But many landmines and unexploded ordnance remained. And the year I was there, clearance was ongoing. So there were deminers living among us, going out and demining. They live in sort of military camps. So kind of going alongside people's everyday life was this ongoing demining process. Now, the village chief was very worried that I was going to get myself killed in one way or another. He was paranoid because it would be on his head if I died. And he told me pretty early on, he said, "Gom tao pade pada." And that means, don't go about carelessly. He said, you need to stay on the roads, you need to stay on the paths to people's houses, don't go into the forest, and don't go up into the hills. Which is good advice, and was advice that I largely kept. Now I'm going to get anthropological. You ready? Okay. So, ancient Cambodian tradition has 2 landscapes, and that's what a lot of their sort of thinking about landscape is based on. There's a landscape that's called the Srok, and there's a landscape that's called the Prey. Now, the Srok is the cultivated, domesticated world of agriculture and human dwelling. That's the rice fields. That's the villages. That's the towns. The Prey is the wilderness. This is the forest. 2 landscapes. Traditional Khmer thinking from very ancient periods has held that there are basically 2 kinds of spirits who split themselves and live between the 2 landscapes. Spirits who are in the Srok are largely viewed as being protectors of human beings, and they will bless you if you seek their blessing. Spirits who live in the Prey are considered wild, fearsome, malevolent, wild spirits, just like wild creatures. There's one whole class of spirits that we'll be talking about today. The Nekta, which literally means the old ones, but a lot of people translate it as the guardians. The Nekta of the Srok help people. They belong to places. The Nekta of the Prey, they guard the forest. Yeah.
Could you change your
color? Does it not show? Okay. I can change my color. I'm not going to draw very much, but here. Now, these old ideas of landscape and spirits are very spatial in nature, these ancient Khmer cosmologies. Spirits are territorial. They're connected to place. So always in Cambodia, from ancient times, human movement or displacement has an element of spiritual risk, because you're leaving one place where you've made a relationship with the spirits. If you're living in a cultivated place, they're on your side. You're going somewhere else, you risk encountering other spirits. So any kind of movement for them involves human risk. Now, when Buddhism came to Cambodia, I don't know when, I'm terrible with my religious history, basically, Buddhism enveloped the idea of the Srok. People talk about Srok now as being under the blessing of a Buddhist king. If you have a Buddhist king and he has well-being, then the land itself is fertile. But the forest, the wilderness, remains outside of the domain of Buddhism and the Buddhist king. So everyone I'm talking about today would classify themselves as a Theravada Buddhist, which is 98% of Cambodia. But since they resettled a forested landscape, they had to encounter and deal with these sort of what we call extra Buddhist folk religion ideas of spirits that predate Buddhism and still continue on today. So far, so good? You with me? Okay. Now, centuries ago, oh wait, that doesn't work. I need more arrows. Here's the other thing about these two landscapes. Okay, you've got two landscapes, but they're not permanent and they're not static. Cambodians have always recognized that these landscapes have the potential to be transformed from one to the other. You can cycle from Srok to Prai, you can cycle back. So you can clear and cultivate the forest and make it into a cultivated dwelling place. In the same manner, if you neglect a cultivated dwelling place in a place as tropical as Cambodia, within 20, 30 years, it completely grows back and grows over. So there's always this potential of transformation in their traditional ideas of landscape. Centuries ago, Cambodia was completely forested. If you go there now, you'll notice the whole middle of the country is basically open floodplains of paddy rice. People are very aware that human endeavor can change a landscape. So these people, these desperate people who needed land, were both coming to a former front line, a former battlefield, and engaging in a very ancient practice of trying to settle in the forest and make it back into this cultivated landscape. Their dream of being able to make this is what drove them to sort of risk the hazards of resettlement. But to successfully navigate the material landscape, I went to that part of Cambodia thinking it was going to be all about the landmines, that would be what was on everybody's mind, on everybody's eyes, and that is a major concern for them. But to successfully navigate a material landscape, they had to also successfully navigate the landscape of the spirits as well. And so that's what I'm talking about today. I'm going to talk about just two kinds of spirits in this lecture. One is I'm going to talk about the guardians of the forest, so the Nekta Prai. So this is a particular kind of forest spirit. They're traditionally seen as the bad guys from people's perspective. And then for the last 10 minutes of the lecture, last 15 minutes, I'm going to talk about another kind of spirit called the Satjang, which is a particularly different thing. Okay. So, forest guardian spirits. When I moved to the village, I started asking people about beliefs in the spirits, and it rapidly became very clear to me that there was this wide, lots and lots of contrast in how people talked about what the spirits were like before the war and what the spirits were like in the post-war era. And this was not just by the younger generation. This is by people who had lived through the war itself. So it's the elder generation having these conversations. Huge discourses and contrasts in how people talked about these spirits before and after. Basically, I'll summarize what I'm going to say in more detail. It was agreed upon by almost everyone that these cruel forest spirits had diminished in both presence and power. People felt there weren't as many around and that they were less malevolent than in the past. Yet at the same time, ritual practice to try to appease these spirits was still very ongoing and very common. So there's a difference between people's discourse changing and yet their ritual practices. So the forest spirits before, because the elders of the village would sit and talk to me, there was very widespread agreement that forest spirits in Cambodia before the war were this word in Khmer that is called gat. Gat means like cruel and malevolent, easily angered. People talked about how the spirits would kill or displease people who trespassed upon their territory. Sometimes spirits would manifest themselves in dreams, but more often Cambodians talk about spirits. These forest spirits would come and they actually make you sick. They grip your stomach, they twist it, they cause illnesses that involve seizures and convulsions. And malaria, since ancient times, has been seen as, although people recognize it's caused by mosquitoes, malaria is sent by spirits if you trespass on their territory. Malaria is particularly common in the forested mountains of Cambodia. So someone who has malaria generally assumes that they've somehow offended the spirits traditionally. Now also, the animals in the forest that are under the protection of these spirits, because remember, they're guarding the forest. Large, powerful animals like tigers or big snakes, are considered to be enchanted animals. The spirits use them to do their bidding. A tiger might be just a tiger, or it might be an enchanted tiger. You're never sure, so you have to be very careful when you're around a tiger in the jungle. And if you trespass and you offend these spirits, quite often they'll send one of those animals to kill you. So someone who is killed by a tiger, they assume it's because they offended the spirits. Now, in the pre-war era, anyone seeking to enter the forest to hunt, who wanted safe passage through it, or to try to cultivate it, would have to have special magical powers and knowledge of how to request permission to be there. Very elaborate knowledge of special offerings that were needed. And many people talked about you could be cursed if you set foot on the territory of a powerful spirit. If you left the forest and you forgot to make a thank offering, thanking the spirit for letting you live, it might come after you and take you then. So a lot of fear. These were considered very strong, very powerful spirits. They're particularly considered to reside in trees or near trees. They protect the trees. People who go in to cut wood and fell trees are particularly vulnerable to the anger of these spirits. Hunting also angered them. And so hunting was, back in the pre-war era, a magic pursuit. Someone who was a hunter had to also be a religious practitioner who knew how to deal with spirits. You couldn't just wander in there with your musket. You needed to have special magic to go in. Now, when Handsome Village was originally cleared from the forest in the 1960s, many, many people were falling ill from malaria. And I actually, when I was in the village, I finally managed to find a few elders who had actually been there in that early first settlement period. One of them was the oldest man in the area. He was ancient. His name was Tha Hen. And he, it turned out, was a religious practitioner, a sort of... He was kind of Buddhist, but he really wasn't. He was much more one of these special magic people who knew about the forest. And he had moved to the area, and he said he's the first person who tried to initiate a relationship with these wild spirits so that people could try to make it into Srok. And basically, he said he'd made a food offering, and he'd prayed to them, and he'd said to them, "Please stop harming people, and I will feed you." So he set up this relationship in which the basis is, I'll read you one of the things he said. He said, I said to them, if you want to harm the people because you are so hungry, ask me. If you're hungry for a boiled chicken or bananas or coconuts or candy or alcohol, I will make it and give it to you. You stop cursing them, listen to me, wait for me, and I will make you food to eat. And so he said once he started doing that and he had this relationship of making food offerings, people would come to him if they fell ill and he would help intervene for them. So he saw himself as being sort of the first level in taming some of these forest spirits in the 1960s. Now, 30 years later, the post-war era comes. People are entering and clearing land that's returned to forests in a really similar manner to what was happening in the late 1960s. And clear continuity in ritual practice, particularly in this idea of asking permission and making food offerings, which I'll talk about in a minute, accompanied by asking the spirits for protection, safe passage, and well-being. But there was all this debate, like I mentioned, about forest spirits in the present. Widespread agreement in the village that the forest guardians had become weak. And there was all this debate and disagreement about why they'd become weak. There's two main theories. One is that they diminished in power, and the second was that they'd actually left. They'd fled, and they'd gone somewhere else. So the taming idea is kind of what I was just talking about. People were arguing, if you come in, if you make food offerings, if you give them food, they start to get gentler because they're hungry. The reason they're so cruel is because they're ravenous. Another interpretation, a really interesting one, is that some of these forest spirits had actually converted to Buddhism. Okay? I had some Buddhist elders very seriously discuss this with me. There's a mountain where some forest monks had come to meditate. The mountain used to have a very cruel mountain spirit, the elders said. But they said the mountain spirit must have started listening to the monks, watching the monks, and it now holds to the precepts of Buddhism, and it stopped killing people. Because Buddhism is a pacifist religion. And they said, you can tell because there was a huge white tiger. It was a tiger that was also enchanted. It guarded the mountain, and it left. And that was a sign to the villagers that the spirit had stopped protecting this mountain. And in their view, the spirit had now held to the, had become basically a Buddhist spirit. And there's a number of people who told me that in the village. So sort of a blending of Buddhism and these pre-Buddhist beliefs. But more interesting, I think, and maybe a more common explanation, was this idea that the spirits had fled. People talked about flight a lot as the explanation for the present-day weakness. And people said the spirits had fled because of the war, because of the destruction of the forest under the Khmer Rouge period. And in these accounts, I started to realize that people, in ways I think would not have been common before the war, saw the human, these forest spirits as being sort of vulnerable to human action, or vulnerable in ways similar to people are. So under the Khmer Rouge forced labor cooperatives, a lot of forest was cleared in the area. And a number of the elders who had lived through that talked about how they burned the forest. And they said to me that the forest guardians fear fire. If you burn the forest, the spirits will flee. Many people argued if these trees get cut down, the spirits flee. They go somewhere else. Some people said, well, they go somewhere else, but they leave behind like little spirits. It's just the big guys who went away. So there's all these debates, a lot of argument. People don't agree about these things. I think that's true in all of our religions, right? And kind of the logic would loop. People would argue, the spirits left because the trees were cut down. Then somebody else would argue, well, the spirits had to leave first or we couldn't have cut down the trees, right? So people would have these sort of long discussions about how this worked. But in the alternate explanation, the fear of war is where you really start to see people talking as if these spirits were vulnerable and, in fact, having the same kind of pain and suffering as the human populace. Some people said spirits are frightened when people shoot at each other. Some people said once the Khmer Rouge came and took over and said the spirits were not in control, the spirits were lost. They weren't like before. Some people said they flee war because they can be shot. So spirits are recognized as being spirits. They're invisible. They don't have corporeal bodies. But a number of people said, yeah, but if a bullet passes through the air where the spirit is, the spirit can be wounded. The spirit can actually be killed. These aren't immortal beings any more than people think people are. Spirits have to also incarnate and reincarnate again and again in a Buddhist cycle of things. So in this sort of explanation, you could see how sort of the growing vulnerability of the populace during war got sort of put over onto people trying to make sense of what had happened to the spirits. The population had fled the intensifying fighting. The population had been part of experiencing death and loss and the cutting down of forests, the loss of their homes. And as a number of people, some people would say directly, they fear guns like we do, one old man said. When fighting starts, they flee like we do. So these very suddenly human-like interpretations of these spirits. Now, the spirits weren't thought to have ceased to exist, but to have gone somewhere else. So the people in the village would always say to me, it's not that they've left the forest. It's not that they've left Cambodia. They've gone to where the forest is now. So it was a displacement rather than people saying they didn't believe anymore. They're just saying they're not here anymore. Now, not everybody thought this. There are voices in the village who said the spirits are still here. And despite the fact that there's all this discourse about this, I met almost no one in the village who'd failed to do the correct ritual practice to make sure to not offend the spirits. So even though a lot of people said they were weaker or that they had fled, people continued to do the ritual practice to make sure. And the most important thing about that for people was before you cleared land, before you tried to build your house or plant your farm, you had to make an offering and ask permission to the spirits. You couldn't skip that and just start doing it because that was trespassing on their territory. People talked a lot about how could you behave safely in the forest? How could you avoid making the spirits angry? And there was a lot of discussion about what is immorality in the forest. And there was a lot of discussion, a lot of different answers, but there was agreement on a couple points. And one was greed. Greed was seen as being absolutely unacceptable to the spirits. Also, loose talk. The Khmer would say, if you talk disrespectfully, you don't recognize you're in a holy place, that can be something that can draw the attention of the spirits as well. So, if you do such a thing, the way in which a spirit might punish you had changed because now there weren't so many tigers, but there was landmines. Okay, so people said, often people would interpret if someone stepped on a landmine, it's possible they'd offended the spirits. Just like in the old days, if you got eaten by a tiger, people would think that you defended the spirits. But people would say over and over again, spirits will not harm people who do good. People who have wicked hearts can't live in the forest. There's this sort of implication that if you could succeed to live, clear, cut, and survive in that forest, that you were a person who had a good or moral heart. And almost every household had what they call a rong shrine for the forest guardians, which is just a small wooden altar that's outside of the home. It's out in the outside world because it's for those outside spirits. And before people cleared the forest, like I said, it's absolutely imperative to make an offering on that shrine. I only met one family that hadn't done that. And they were a family that felt that that was incompatible with their Buddhism. But most families did both practices. Any offering to the spirits includes liquid, smoke, and fire. You have to have three elements. One of the deminers in the village I was talking to, he revealed to me one day that he makes those offerings before he demines a new part of the forest. He operates one of those huge demining machines. The Japanese government donated them. They weigh several tons. They have an enormous flail on the front. They're for anti-personnel mines. You drive this tank-like thing across the field, and the flail spins thousands of hammers, and it sets off the mines. Before he would go into a field to do that, he would always make one of these offerings on the machine, and he would pray to the guardian spirits that might be protecting the field. And he said, you just talk to them, you just tell them honestly. He says, we tell them we've come to cleanse the mines, to liberate the people. We ask, please don't be offended, grandfather, grandmother, and we ask them to keep any of the mines from being tilted, because a mine that's tilted in tropical mud or soil is much more dangerous. Usually mines go off from a direct hit from the top. If it's been knocked sideways, it's more unstable. I also found out halfway through my year that when my host family would make these kind of offerings, they would also make those offerings on the tractor, because our family tractor sometimes was going on land that still had landmines around the edges. There was always a risk that you might hit a landmine that you'd missed in your clearance. And my host mother said, like, yeah, this is about landmines. So she said, basically, we're just praying that in case the tractor rolls across a landmine, that the spirit will keep our son safe. She said, we don't know if there's a spirit in the tractor. We don't know if there's a spirit in the field. But just in case, you do this, you ask. You ask for this protection. And alongside this whole dialogue about respectfully acknowledging and supplicating the spirits was this repeated assertion that this new kind of idea, people kept saying to me, the spirits respect the fact that you're destitute. They'll respect if you have a great need. Over and over again, people would say to me, the spirits took pity on us because we were poor. The spirits let us come here and settle the forest because we were desperate. And when people talked about the prayers that they prayed when they asked if they could settle and disturb the forest, it was requested on the basis of need. It was very important to people that need was respected and greed was not. They made a very clear distinction. So here's one of those prayers someone said to me. He said, we came here and we asked the guardians to please allow us to live here. We are not here to defeat them, to lord it over them. We are destitute. We have no place to live apart from this one. Please let us stay here and have well-being. If we do not come to live here, we have nowhere else to go. Alongside that was this counter-narrative that the spirits were much more likely to punish greedy people, people who would come who didn't really need to be there, people who were there to grab land. Rich landholders were usually not viewed favorably, people buying up big tracts of land that people said, those are the kinds of people that don't respect the spirits, and the spirits don't respect them. Okay. That's almost 30 minutes. So for the last part, I'm going to switch gears. So we've got these guys. They've changed, or they haven't changed. There's debate. But most people think they're weaker. Most people think they're diminished. Some people think they now will respect human need. Here's a whole other category or kind of spirit called the Satjang. Now, people talk about the Satjang, and in these stories, they stress the potential of the forest to become this place where they could be safe, rather than this emphasis on hunger and danger that they got when they talk about the guardian forest spirits. And these stories about the Satjang, as far as I could tell, are actually unique to this part of Cambodia. In other parts of Cambodia, the Satjang are described as something rather different, They're described as forest hermits who have supernatural powers. If you walk into temples in Cambodia, they're very fond of concrete statues of different mythological things. The Sat Jong is always wearing like this, he's a very tacky statue, always, for some reason. He's got like this tacky leopard skin outfit on, he's got white hair up in a top knot, and he usually is carrying a staff. That's what people in most parts of Cambodia think of, these like forest supernatural monk guys. In this part of Cambodia, the Sat Jong were described as this totally different sort of thing. They're distinguished from other kinds of spirits, but they're seen as being human, but not quite. They're kind of in between the human and the spirit world. As one person explained to me, they have bodies like humans, but usually humans can't see them. The Sat Jong live in a world that's parallel to our own, but in which the door between the two only sometimes opens. The best thing I could think of when I was there trying to make sense of it is some of the old English stuff I've read about the fairy world. If you've read some of the early fairy stuff, they can come and go between the worlds, but they're not always here. They live in this other sort of parallel land. It was a very similar kind of idea. They live in our world, people said, but they're invisible to us. So it's kind of like a dimension that's invisible but also here. People said they reside in the forest, or what we see as the forest. It is the forest, but in their side of it, they're actually living in these beautiful gardens, these beautiful orchards, these lands of prosperous bounty. So they say, we see the forest full of trees, they see it as full of fruit. The fruits are there, they said. The orchards are there, but we can't see them. So there's this whole other world just beyond the veil that we can't see. They're said to be fond of caves, and that they would actually have houses in caves that, again, we just couldn't see. And the elders would say, it used to be before the war, you'd go in the caves and you could see the marks of the broom. You could see that they'd swept the floor, but you can't see. It looks like rocks to us, but that's their furniture. So again, it's there, but beyond sight. And other elders have said, in the old days, you'd see golden lights coming from the caves at night. That was their lights. And you'd hear this sort of tinkling music on the wind at night. Now, they could appear to people. And if they do appear, they usually appear in pairs as an elderly couple with long white hair. And they live in these houses, in their villages, in these woods. Now, they're described as distinct from people and distinct from these other kinds of force guardian spirits. Unlike humans, the Sat Jong are described as always honest. Unlike the guardian spirits, they don't harm or curse people who trespass on their territory. In fact, they can take pity on people and help you and show you the way. Also, they're never greedy. This is this repeated refrain when people talk about the Sat Jong. So if you get lost, they might appear and tell you the way home. They might even feed you. If you lie to them, if you're greedy, if you do anything immoral, they basically throw you back out and you're back in the forest and you're lost again. So they kind of test people. And people would say over and over again that before the war, we had more interaction with the Sat Jong. There's this repeated refrain that people had a general decline in morality since the war. This is a thing you hear in many parts of Cambodia. People become more violent, more selfish, more ambitious. Things have changed. And one of the results of that is less access to this other world. So everyone agreed that they're still around them, but they're very seldom seen or encountered in the present era. And I want to close by reading, actually I'm going to take 5 minutes past what I'm supposed to take, but I want to tell you one detailed Sat Jong story. I want to read it to you from the narrator's words. And this is the only Sat Jong story I ever heard that took place in the middle of or near the end of the war. Most of the stories people would tell you were like, this happened when I was very small, my grandparents saw this. This is a recent Sat Jong story, and that makes it unusual. It was set in the 1980s. In the midst of the war and turmoil that marked the life of my narrator, who was an elderly man, he was in a refugee camp, and he said, this is a story about some other refugees who were in the camp. Okay, so he didn't say it was his story, he's telling the story of someone else. So, 6 or 7 young men who were bored and constrained by life trapped in the refugee camp, they snuck out and they climbed a mountain. And here is his story. He says, and 3 of them were lost. They reached the top of the mountain and saw no paths. They walked and walked, but still arrived at the same place. That night they were strongly hungry. Then the satchang said, "These are righteous people." So they wanted to feed them. They ate and drank at the place of the satchang. There were pomelo trees. Pomelos are our Asian grapefruit. Bananas and sweet potatoes to eat, and rice. They were a couple like humans, like an elderly couple who lived on the mountain. The three men told people later that there were only three rolls of rice on each plate, the size of a child's wrist. For those hungry men, it looked too little to fill them up. Then the old woman said to them, "Grandchildren, let's eat rice." They finished the first piece, and their energy returned. The second piece, and were almost full. The third piece, and they were as full as when we eat two or three full plates of rice at home. Then the satchang went to pick a pomelo. They brought back just one and cut it into three pieces. When the men slept, it was in a small hut. They slept in hammocks, but no mosquitoes bit them. They slept easily until dawn. Early in the morning, when the light came, when the sun rose, the three men said their farewells. And they said, "Grandfather, sir, where is the way to the refugee camp?" The elders pointed to a very dark way. The men saw only forest, but as they went along, there was a road shining with light, a road where hundreds and thousands had walked. They had opened the road so it could be seen. They descended. They went straight along it. They walked down from the mountain easily in an instant. When the young men reached their homes, they were asked, "Where did you sleep last night?" And they said, "We slept in the house of grandfather and grandmother on the mountain, but there was no such house. I have walked there also, but I have never seen a house there." So this was his story. Now, in the story that he heard, while he was displaced and living in this state of great insecurity, in this story there's like this glimpse of this other world, this world of mercy, this world of bounty, this world where there's a road, even in the most remote wilderness. The men are lost, but the satchang are at home in the dark woods. Instead of refugee rations, the seemingly small amounts they are fed fill them utterly. They sleep easily, in contrast to the camp residents, who slept pretty much every night with the threat of shelling or having to flee. So the satchang stories emphasize morality for people and what it means to be moral in a Khmer context, but they also function as a promise for people of the potential of the forest. So even in these dark forests, the world is full of agricultural bounty. So when you enter their world, which is actually our own world, you get this glimpse of what the forest can be. It also provides a vision of what humans should be. So descriptions of the satchang link their morality to their agricultural plenty that they enjoy. It's human failing that leads to the satchang fading from view. They remain present, just out of view. And in this world that we can so seldom see, the Khmer say, are these lives that are still full of agricultural and moral goodness. So in this manner, and I'll close with this, the satchang illustrate for the Cambodians in these stories, in this village, both promise and judgment. A promise of what the forest can become and a judgment of what humans so often fail to be. And I think I'll stop with that. Okay. Apparently I'm self-moderating. Okay, questions. You don't have to ask any. Rats. Okay, Olivia.
How would they perceive foreigners in their interactions with the spirits? Like you, for example, do they think that you would have the same consequences and that you would be obligated to behave the same way that they would towards them?
People knew that I was Christian. And they don't expect people who follow other religions to follow the same practices. I didn't have anyone ever... I was invited to watch things. I was not expected to participate. Does that make sense? So I am not sure I could answer from their perspective.
But like, do they still believe that the spirits would send wild animals to attack you if you trespassed also?
I don't know. I never went into those places. That's a good question. I didn't ever ask what would happen to me. That's a very interesting question, which I completely failing to ask answer. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Yeah.
Also, like,
But they also send offerings to the Sanji. Like, they gave out these offerings for protection, but they didn't.
No. The Satsang aren't.
Can you repeat the question before you answer it?
Yes. Okay. She said, hold on. She said, do people make offerings to the Satsang in the same way they make to the forest guardians? To which the answer is no. You do not need, they don't mind if you, there's no sense of trespass. They're just there. And sometimes you see them. They're in a whole different sort of spirit category. You're not expected to make offerings to them of any kind. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Did they have a spiritual explanation for the war, or was it just something that humans did?
Some Buddhists explain the war in terms of Buddhist prophecy of an era of great destruction, in which the entire world reverses its normal turn, and in which great chaos and misery falls on the land. There are some Buddhist sort of apocalyptic prophecies that people would quote to talk about this was that time that happened to Cambodia, and that's why it was so unbelievably terrible. So there were some Buddhist explanations. Sort of the extra Buddhist explanations, people tended to blame it more on just the Khmer Rouge being cruel and evil and misguided. Some people, Khmer refugees in the States, I've heard some people kind of argue the Khmer Rouge were connected to these evil spirits, but that's usually a refugee explanation from people who fled Cambodia, trying to understand a world they left behind. In Cambodia, people talk a lot more about human evil.
Yeah, I would have understood it just the opposite, that the guardian spirits didn't protect the forest against the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah.
And therefore, maybe that's why they were diminished.
Yeah, that would be the local village level understandings, for sure. Yeah, people would say to me, you know, the Khmer Rouge, the forest guardian spirits were afraid of them because they were these cruel, disrespectful people, and they basically, some people said, because I had a young Cambodian woman with me one day from the city, and she said, why didn't they protect people? She was talking more about these ones, but she was like, if the guardian spirits were good, why didn't they save us when the Khmer Rouge came? And the old man in the village said to her, well, they're foolish. They're not wise spirits. They just want to protect the place they protect. So when the Khmer Rouge sent people in to cut the forest, they put curses on people, whether or not they were basically slave labor. They don't distinguish between, right? So there is all these sort of, but there's not a lot of agreement on these things. Your question is, people are struggling very much to make sense of what happened.
The problem is they didn't protect the forest.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, Lori.
I'm wondering, in the area where you live, were there pragmatic consequences of these beliefs, especially the extra Buddhist ones, in terms of creating function among the people and the ways they interacted and the way their culture worked?
Wow, I don't know how to answer that. Function. Well, one of the things I found interesting is people talked about before, like, you really couldn't cut down those forests or you would die. But now people are sort of pragmatically reinterpreting, if we need it, if our motives are pure, they'll let us, right? So they were kind of reinterpreting the way this, the spirit reacted to them in response to their need. So I'd say they're doing reinterpretive work. Traditionally, I don't know that I think these landscape things have a function so much as they're used to sort of describe people's experience of one kind of world being safe and one being frightening and dangerous. But I'm not sure. I'm terrible with functionalist interpretations. We switched to my father. Yeah, Nate.
What were the dynamics like for the one Buddhist family that refused to make sacrifices? Did you talk to them specifically or ask about them? Or?
They believed in the spirit. I mean, Tha Uyên, he's a traditional healer, and I learned a lot from him about ideas. He was a very strong, devout Buddhist elder. He was sometimes unpopular in the Buddhist temple with the other elders because he was like the most... People would sometimes not invite him to stuff because he would tell people off for not being pure enough in their Buddhist practices. But he wasn't shunned in the village, right? And people respected him, but it was also kind of like, if we want to have a good party, like, he's not the guy to invite because, like, he's going to be like, that is Buddhist, that's not Buddhist. Most people mixed stuff, and he was very strict. But he was a very respected man, and he would talk to me all about these spirits. It's just he doesn't fear them or do anything with them. He doesn't disbelieve in them, but he just would be like, this is, Buddhism says no. And yeah, so he was a very unusual case, actually. He is a traditional healer, but entirely medicinal. He won't truck with the spirits to do his healing. It's all about collecting bark and special medicine from the forest. So a very interesting man, actually. Yeah, Nate.
Was the idea of the spirits fleeing and being vulnerable just like people?
Yeah.
Was that just a projection that they had... that had arisen during the war? Or was that something that was around before? Like,
no.
Being viewed as, like, being IDPs and
country
and stuff like that. Like, that was just something that had, like, brought them down to their level, like, made it more accessible, like, to make sense of their world?
I think it's an interpretive project. I think people are trying to understand what happened, why didn't these beliefs work, and they're seeing their own, so they're kind of suddenly seeing the spirits. Maybe they had the same kind of experience that we did.
And did that affect their praxis?
No.
Okay.
That was what I was trying to say. Even though there's this ongoing dialogue, they're weaker, they're more vulnerable than we thought, they're bland. Basically, the word they're using, sap, literally means bland. The spirits are bland. They're not what we thought they were, these cruel forest spirits. But they maybe their, people still kept doing the same practices. Does that make sense? So changing discourse, but ongoing practice. So the landscape is awash in flux, material landscape and the cosmological. But you see these cosmologies, they're both durable and they're shifting at the same time. It's very complicated and interesting.
And my next question
yeah.
is just a little bit more simple.
Yes.
You say that the Cambodian people understand that landscapes can change.
Yeah.
And the difference between the Sarok and the Prai, they, like, if they go ahead and they clear their field, will that automatically change a Prai to a Sarok? Or, like, how?
It has to be larger than a field. But, yeah, if you cut down a whole forest and cultivate it, Sarok is not just a field. It's basically a realm of dwelling. So a whole village with farmland around it would be considered Sarok. One person making a little farm in the middle of the forest, they haven't got there yet. Right? They're trying. But the Sarok is seen as almost like it's a communal cultivated space.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Kind of.
Kind of, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Two questions, one polls for the next. Are there indigenous Christians in that community, and how do they interface with this worldview?
There are none. Right, the week before I left, I found out there was one Christian man about 5 miles down the road, but it was too late. I tried to set up a meeting with him, but because I was very intrigued to meet. He had become a Christian in the refugee camps, I think people said, and he'd come back. A number of people in my village listened to Christian radio. It was kind of the only access they had to Christian stuff. I found out about halfway through my year that there actually had been a church in my village briefly. My host family, which is Buddhist, hadn't told me about it because they didn't want me to ruin my reputation by going to it. Because they said basically a man had come and said, I'm a Christian, started a church. And a lot of people had gone because a lot of them had heard in the refugee camps, had some exposure. And they were interested and they wanted to know more. And he was a bad man. His teaching was terrible. And he basically told people a couple months in, they weren't welcome to come. If you can't tithe, you can't come to church. These are very poor people. So people in this area are not, they don't suffer fools gladly. And they're like, well, we're out of here then. So they just completely stopped. So it had just fallen apart and he'd gone off to wherever. I don't know who he was. He wasn't in the area. So there was a very negative, it was an interesting mix. People open to Christianity from what they heard in the camps and would discuss it with me, but their local experience with a local Cambodian pastor had been very, very negative, which I think is a terrible thing. So I knew a couple people who listened to Christian radio. Also, one guy I was quite close to is kind of like my brother-in-law with my family relationship there. He would listen to Christian radio. He also was Buddhist, and he also made a number of offerings to spirits because he was trying to figure out what would work. His family was having very, very bad fortune for years, and he was basically trying everything he could think of. And so he was interested and would listen. I think he had a Bible, and he'd listen to Christian radio, but he didn't have, there's no community of Christians in that village. So, yeah. Yeah, Tom.
To the people that you worked with, did it make any difference to them where these landmines came from? Who
planted them? Who made them? Was there any connection to you, U.S. government? Does that make any difference spiritually for them?
No. Okay. You ready for this? Okay, this is Buddhist. The Khmer say, "Min min mada." A mine has a master, but the master is not the person who laid the mine. The master is the person who explodes the mine. This is a karmic view of a landmine accident. You won't step on that mine unless you've run out of merit. So if you haven't run out of merit, this is how Buddhists explain how people survive the war and running through fields filled with landmines. If you haven't run out of merit, they say your life is like the thin edge of a knife blade. It's very hard to kill you because you've got merit left. As soon as you've run out of merit, then, and they'll tell stories like, that's how they explain, 8 people are walking through the forest in a line. The last person, the commander, steps on the mine. The first 8 didn't. Everybody stepped on the mine. It doesn't go off until the person who deserves it merit-wise steps on it. So that's one whole set of explanations for landmines in a Buddhist ethos. There's also, however, people debating about whether it's to do with these malevolent spirits. So it's not one or the other. A lot of people I knew in the village who'd had landmine accidents, they framed it in terms of Buddhism. So they'd said to me, I must have run out of merit, and that's why I stepped on this mine. So
who planted these mines?
Both the government forces and the Khmer Rouge planted an immense amount of landmines. Landmines, depending on which side, they came from about 15 different countries, but the majority were from Vietnam, Russia, China, the U.S., and the U.K., and when you go through like the ordnance and stuff, it's from all these different countries. A huge number of countries funded the landmine, and they were cheap. Landmines are cheap, so.
Are the governments cleaning them up now?
No, Tom. The U.S. government gives a fair bit of money to demining efforts. There's some questions of whether that's sort of sinister. The thing about supporting demining efforts is you learn more about how to make better landmines. You do, because you're learning how to defuse them, which ones lasted, which ones... So there's all these questions about when governments fund demining, are they really? Is that really a humanitarian thing to do, or is that actually helping their own weaponry development of countries that have not signed the landmine ban, which the U.S. is one of them. So there is American government money coming to the Cambodian government to help with demining, absolutely. And then there's a bunch of professional demining NGOs. We call it humanitarian demining. These are non-governmental demining groups, like Mine Action Group or Halo Trust. So yeah. Yeah.
Two questions. Do the Prime and the Sejong, which one now? Do they have any interactions whatsoever? And secondly, do people view the Cry as having influence? Like, if you put something into the forest of arms, like mines, would they view them as having influence over that whole quote-unquote biome?
Yes. Yeah. Whatever goes into that forest goes into the domain of the spirits that control that land, which is why people argue that spirits can use a landmine to punish a person, in the same way that in the ancient days they would have used a tiger before we hunted them all out. Your first question, a number of people said to me that the forest spirits fear the Satjang, because the Satjang are pure, and they're moral, and the forest spirits are not. So people made a clear hierarchy. There wasn't like they have a war going on, but they said to me they fear them. The forest spirits will eat whatever food you give them, even if it's bad, even if it's spoiled. The Satjang only eat their own pure and fragrant food. So they made these really clear distinctions between these two kinds of beliefs. Yeah. Okay, one more question. Mike.
Not to get into theology, but Christian worldview. Can you give a few perspectives on your take on all this?
I knew you were going to do that to me. No, I don't think I have a good missiological perspective for you on this. Give me a specific missiological question. What is it you want to know about my worldview on this?
Just your take on it.
My take on this. I definitely come at this from an anthropological perspective. I want to understand how people make sense of the world, both the material world and the cosmological world. And I notice going in, there's all kinds of literature about what people believed about the forest and forest spirits, but I noticed almost nobody had actually asked people who were trying to live in and settle forested domains. And I thought that was a gap. You can't just say people think this and not actually talk to people who are actually doing this. So this is just one chapter of my thesis, but the point of it was to say, let's try to find out what people actually are doing right now, thinking right now, as opposed to kind of just talking about sort of ancient literature on what people believe about this. Whether I think it's real or true, I don't know. Some of it I think probably is, and some of it probably is affected by people's psychological states. But I don't feel that I'm in a position to kind of weigh or judge that. But I know that's not a very satisfying answer. Can we end with that? Thank you very much, guys.